Today, there are lawmakers in Washington who are undertaking a brazen power grab to tip the balance of the highest court in the land. We're going to unpack what they want to do and why it's so dangerous. Hi, I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is First Liberty Live. We also have on the line here, I'll punch him up so you can see him. We have Mike Berry. Say hi, Mike.
Hey, everyone. Hey, Stuart.
He is our general counsel here at First Liberty Live. Because of the ongoing ice storm here in Texas, we're doing what we like to call First Liberty Live Home Edition. So it's a little different than what you'll usually see, but we wanted to go ahead and still connect with you on this day, even with the nasty weather that we're enduring here in the Lone Star State. Also, before we start, make sure you're subscribed to First Liberty Live. If you go to firstlibertylive.com, it's perfectly free. You can drop in there, click on the big blue subscribe button, and that way we will let you know every time we're about to do a live episode, and that way you won't miss a thing. We want you to be part of this every time we're out. Mike, let's start with the most fundamental question. What is it that we're talking about? I mean, what is it, and how exactly do they want to change the balance of power?
Yeah, well, pardon the pun, but let's unpack court packing, right? So what is court packing? Well, you get a start back in 1937. Actually,
go ahead.
To be precise, it was February 5th, 1937, when President Franklin Roosevelt introduced a plan that he called, I don't think he called it this, but what is now referred to as Roosevelt's court packing scheme. So why would President Roosevelt want to pack the courts? Well, he had unveiled a number of very ambitious and aggressive and progressive legislative ideas and agenda. And the relatively conservative court back then began just routinely rejecting and repudiating President Roosevelt's agenda. He didn't like that, as you can imagine. So he realized there are, you know, this conservative Supreme Court continues to reject my ideas and my vision. I can't change the people who are on the court because, of course, under our Constitution, the justices on the Supreme Court have lifetime appointments. So he decided, well, then what I can do is change the math, right? If there are 9 justices on the court, and there are 5 who are conservative and 4 who are liberal, so 5 vote against me, 4 vote for me. Well, if I just change the math and add more justices to the court, then I can have, you know, 6 vote for me and 5 against, right? If there's 11 justices, or if I increase it to 13, I might be able to have, 9 and 4, or, 7 and 6, or whatever the math turns out as, right?
And so, and I think you've got a simple graphic there to show how that works, right?
Yeah. So, you know, if we look at the current court right now, this is what it looks like, right? In the red here, there are currently 6 conservative justices on the court and 3, liberal justices. And if I wanted to pack the court so I could get my way, then what would I do? If I'm on the blue side, well, I'm simply going to increase the number of seats on the court and fill those seats with my preferred picks of people who are going to advance my agenda until I get to a number where I feel comfortable that they're going to reliably vote in favor of supporting whatever it is that I want to pass. So that's court packing in its essence.
And there's a basic philosophical difference between the two sides that you showed. We often use the terms conservative and liberal, but it really has to do with their view of the Constitution and how they see it applied. Unpack that for us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is something that, folks, if you've been paying attention over the last 4 years and you've seen the record number of judicial appointments during the Trump administration, you probably began to hear the word textualist, originalist, constitutionalist. And that's because there's this notion that if you are a conservative, as that term is traditionally used, it means you believe that the Constitution should be interpreted, or any text, a piece of legislation, a book, whatever it might be, should be interpreted as it was written, right? As whoever wrote those words intended for it to be interpreted at that time. If you are a liberal or a progressive, Some people refer to this as those who believe in a living constitution, right? In other words, the constitution is a living document. It grows, it evolves, it changes with time, so that even though whatever the people who wrote the constitution intended back in the 18th century, it means something very, very different today in the 21st century. And so as a judge or a justice in the 21st century, I can interpret the Constitution based on what I think it should mean today, regardless of what it originally meant. So those are the competing trains of thought, and that's where you begin to see these struggles for power and control of the courts, because conservatives want judges and justices who will interpret the Constitution as it was written, and liberals and progressives want judges and justices who will interpret the Constitution based on whatever the norms of society are at that particular moment in time.
And one telling aspect of that is, based on that difference of philosophical understanding, you have those that see the living document and those that see that they should apply the Constitution and to the law as a measuring stick and to decide whether a law measures up, that as you just pointed out, if you take that sense that we need to get back to the text as the founders intended, what they meant when they wrote those words, that generally, consistently, you come out with decisions that favor the conservative point of view, whereas the liberal point of view means that you have to take a position on the Constitution that the role of justices is to add to the meaning that's in there, to bring it up to date, is how they like to say it, and you get a whole different kind of conclusion.
Yeah, and the problem with that, Stuart, is that living constitution methodology or philosophy is not what the framers intended. And the reason for that is very self-evident in the Constitution itself, and that is that there is a way of changing the Constitution. The Constitution, actually, it contemplates that it can be changed, right? And that's the way that the framers drafted it. But they wanted a particular procedure to be followed, right? If something can be changed just based on a whim or somebody's fancy or just their own preferences, then anybody can change it to mean anything they want. And so, well, then it's not a very solid document, right? It's not something that's going to stand the test of time as our Constitution has. And so it's not as if our Constitution is just frozen in time and set in stone. It can be changed. It's just that there is a very specific way that it needs to be changed, and it's actually kind of difficult. There's this thing called the separation of powers, and there's three branches of government, and they argue and they go back and forth, and they try to come up with, you know, whatever the change is going to be, and it has to pass that high level, that high standard, in order for us to change the Constitution. And if you can't meet that high standard, then you can't change the Constitution. And I mean, most people who've studied civics and American history in school are familiar with when this happened in the 20th century with this thing called prohibition, right? People decided, hey, we need to pass a constitutional amendment banning, you know, the sale and purchase and consumption of alcohol at certain times and whatnot. Well, the people quickly realized we don't really like that. Let's repeal that amendment to the Constitution. And so they had a constitutional amendment to enact prohibition, and then there was another constitutional amendment to repeal prohibition. But that's pretty rare that you see that happen. So again, there've been less, you know, fewer than 30 amendments to the Constitution. So that should tell you that over the course of, two and a half centuries, it's pretty rare that it gets amended, and it's difficult to do, and that's the way it was supposed to be. But going back to the original point, if it's a living, breathing document, then in essence, you can amend it anytime you want to mean anything you want it to mean.
Without going through the proper protocol, the proper way of doing that. A key point, I think, to understanding all this is that the Constitution does not specify how many people are on the Supreme Court, but it does specify who can make the change to that. Unpack that a bit for us as far as the process for that change to be made, if it's going to happen.
Yeah, let's address this myth, you know, that I sometimes hear, which is, well, having more than nine justices on the Supreme Court would be unconstitutional. That's actually not true. It could be perfectly constitutional to have more than nine justices on the Supreme Court because, just as you said, Stuart, the Constitution does not say anywhere how many justices should be on the Supreme Court. All it says is the Congress is the body, the branch of government that gets to decide how many justices there will be, and the president is the one that gets to nominate who is going to be on the Supreme Court, and then the Senate, so it's not actually even a branch of government, it's one specific part of the legislature, gets to confirm, right? In other words, they're the ones that get to ultimately say whether the president gets to have the person he nominates on the Supreme Court or not. And again, and that's the beauty of our Constitution, is that these brilliant people who sat down and drafted this document understood that there needs to be some tension, some give and take, some back and forth between these three co-equal but separate branches of government. And that's one of the dangers that court packing poses, is that it threatens to upend that.
Well, and one thing I want to point out is it was 84 years ago this month, and you alluded to this earlier, that President Franklin D. Roosevelt made an attempt to do this. He announced his plan to increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court, and his goal is very similar and very familiar to the conversations we're having today across the country, and that is he wanted to tip the court in favor of his policy agenda. Now, Mike, as I look at this photo, I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, and still nine people back then, and we still have nine justices on the court today. Tell us what happened that stopped that change from taking place.
Well, it's actually a pretty fascinating episode in history because FDR, President Roosevelt, was one of the most popular presidents we've ever seen. I mean, he was, you know, elected four times. In fact, we actually had to pass a constitutional amendment, as we've been talking about, to set a term limit on presidents as a result of President Roosevelt's, you know, partly as a result of his popularity. But he wasn't so popular that he could get everything he wanted. You'd think if any president was popular enough, it would be President FDR, right? But yeah. As it were, interestingly, when he announced his court packing plan, two of his most ardent supporters, right? These were Democrat senators who had long supported President Roosevelt and many of his policy goals and agenda. Senator Burton Wheeler and Senator Hatton Sumners both vehemently opposed this idea of court packing. And the reason is actually quite simple and it's beautiful in its simplicity. And that is that court packing, they saw it for what it was. This was a power grab. This was an attempt to simply make the judiciary an extension, a political extension of the office of the president. And that would completely destroy the constitutional order that our framers and the founders had established, which was, as I've been saying, three co-equal but separate branches of government. And the judiciary had to retain its independence. We have to have an independent judiciary that's free from political influence. And if we simply are packing the courts, expanding the number of seats on the Supreme Court and lower courts, and then just packing them with our hand-picked people who are going to just rubber stamp our policies and our agenda, then really the court becomes nothing more than an extension of the presidency. And now you really only have two branches of government, and there's nobody to really hold the president in check because the courts are just going to say, rubber stamp, yes, whatever the president wants, yep, that's what it's constitutional, it's constitutional, it's constitutional. And that's extremely dangerous. And our founders had the foresight and the wisdom to say, that's not the way it's going to be. And thankfully, you had great statesmen like Senator Wheeler, Senator Sumners, taking to the floor of Congress to say, we have got to oppose this. We have to stop this. We can't let this happen. And they were successful. And President Roosevelt was not successful in packing the courts. And that's why we had nine justices in 1937, and we have nine justices in 2021. And hopefully we will continue to only have nine justices on the court.
Now, there are a couple of phrases that we're going to hear a lot as this gets discussed. You just brought up one that I'd like you to describe a little more and help explain why it's such an important concept, and that is the idea of an independent judiciary. It's a big phrase, but it also contains a very big thought. Unpack that for us.
Well, I think the person who put it best was Chief Justice Roberts himself, right? Chief Justice John Roberts of the U.S. Supreme Court, when he was going through his confirmation hearing, and he was asked about what he thought the role of a judge or a Supreme Court justice should be in maintaining the independence of the judiciary. And my understanding, if I recall, is that Chief Justice Roberts is a big baseball fan, as you and I are, Stuart, and he used this beautiful metaphor, an analogy of baseball, and he said, the role of a judge is to call balls and strikes, right? Not to declare or pick winners and losers. Unpacking that, that means, look, if the ball's outside the strike zone, if the pitch is outside the strike zone, you call a ball. If it's inside the strike zone, you call a strike. But you don't decide as a judge who's going to win or lose the game. You simply decide the case is based on the facts and the laws that are before you, without this preconceived notion of, well, this side is, you know, supports the president, and this side doesn't support the president. So I clearly have to decide, you know, pick this side as the winner and this side as the loser. That would completely destroy the independence of the judiciary. And we actually have these things called judicial canons, right? These canons of judicial conduct, and almost all of them. So by canons, it's simply, I don't mean the kind that go boom and blow things up.
Right.
I mean the kind that set, these are, you know, long-standing principles that are set in stone about what judges can and cannot do. And these canons of judicial conduct are almost every single one of them are put in place to ensure that judges adhere to that role of you know, I'm not going to veer outside of my role of simply calling balls and strikes, and I'm not going to pick winners and losers. So that's really what we mean when we say maintaining the independence of the judiciary.
Now, another phrase that's going to come up a lot, and you're using one phrase to describe this, but there's another one that's showing up in headlines lately. Court packing is how this has historically been referred to, but now those who are in favor of it are calling it court reform. Describe for us the difference and why the nuances of language are so important to this battle one way or the other.
Well, I actually think court reform is a pretty accurate term that's being used, because if you think about, just think about the actual word itself, reform. What does that mean? To reform something, right? So
yeah.
to remake it, what are you remaking it into? Well, those who are supporting court packing and so-called court reform, they want to remake and reshape the judiciary into what they want it to be, which is an extension of the political extension of the presidency. Why is that? Because they now have a president and an administration who they believe can advance their progressive, you know, radical agenda. And so in order to accomplish that, they need to ensure that they have judges and justices who are going to say yes to that agenda. And in order to do that, they know that they can't do that with the current makeup of the courts. So what do they have to do? They have to reform the courts into what they want.
All right. Now, you've hinted at this along the way, but I want to ask it as a question so you can say it in one solid, concise statement. What is the right path? There are many different ways this could go, but what's the best path from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, you know, where do we go from here, right? What do we do? Do we just, you know, throw our hands in the air and just say, well, you know, if it happens, it happens? No, absolutely not. You know, First Liberty Institute, this is an issue that's very important to us. Because as most folks know, the fight for religious liberty, sometimes it can hang on a thread, and it can be the difference between one vote on a court. One judge or one justice can, you know, flip their vote and the case goes the entirely opposite direction. And so a case that was there that upheld religious freedom and the Constitution, you add justices to that who are going to vote the opposite way. And all of a sudden, we start losing the freedoms that we've been you know, working so hard to preserve for all these past decades. So, where do we go from here? Well, there are really, as we've talked about, there are two ways that you can increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court. You can pass a law, Congress can pass a law, or we the people can pass a constitutional amendment. Right? Well, in the same way, those are two ways that you can set the number of judges or justices on the Supreme Court. Congress can pass a law saying there shall only be 9 justices on the Supreme Court, or we can pass a constitutional amendment saying the same thing. Now, as I said earlier, the constitutional amendment process is much harder to do by design, but it also means it's harder to be undone, right? Prohibition notwithstanding. We can pass a law, which is a little bit easier, but it's also a little bit easier to be undone. So those are really the two paths forward that I see, constitutional amendment or a law that's passed by Congress. And those are certainly very realistic possibilities. And so those are things that people should be keeping a very, very close eye on.
All right. And we'll be keeping a close eye on this, of course, as well. And we'll be posting updates on firstliberty.org, our primary website, and also, of course, on firstlibertylive.com. We'll continue to have conversations about this topic. We invite you to tune in and be part of those conversations as we go forward. If you enjoy hearing this, please do these conversations we have about religious freedom in the country. Please do subscribe at firstlibertylive.com. Just drop by the page there, and at the very top, you'll see a blue button that says subscribe. Click on that, and we'll send you a reminder each time we go live with these episodes so you don't miss a thing. Next week, our attorney Stephanie Taub will tell us about a couple of cases that we are asking the Supreme Court to consider. One involves school choice, and the other case involves the right of faith-based organizations to decide who they choose as leaders. Mike, I want to thank you for being part of this today. We appreciate your time and your insights.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
All right. It's been a good conversation. And thank you for being part of First Liberty Live.